sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Microsoft flops on earnings. Markets at record highs, and the KRI indicator is showing some interesting characteristics. We have guests Jim O'Shaughnessy and Stanley Dash. All this and much more on episode number 322 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey, how are you? It is an amazing thing, isn't it, watching these markets go up even in the face of some bad news. On Thursday night, last week, we saw Google and Microsoft come out with very disappointing numbers overall, especially where the price had been moving very dramatically higher. And then Microsoft comes out with an absolute bomb. I mean, just a terrible number. And the stock slowly but surely started moving lower after the earnings announcement. And from there, it kept on going down. As a matter of fact, the stock was down, I don't know, 10% or so by the end of the session on Friday. And that was one of the worst performances since, I think, 15 years for Microsoft. Now, where does it go from here is another question. I mean, the thing is that we do see that there is a lot of resistance in the markets for Windows 8. And especially when it comes to the business clients that they have, they're just not making the switch. Not to mention the fact that their tablet is flopping. So all in all, they are a little bit too late on all of this, it seems, and it's really taking its toll. And not to mention the fact that we had seen earlier in the week that PC sales were some of the worst we've seen, and the growth is horrible. A lot of people ask me, you know, why is that? You know, what's the story? Is it the tablets are taking over? And, you know, well, there's a couple of things. First of all, you have to think about the fact that the way that computers are built today, with the graphics processors and with the hard drive capabilities and the cloud, by the way, and the fact also that there hasn't been a real innovation and need for additional speed and computing power from a desktop perspective, all goes into the fact that Windows 7 being a very solid platform, and the fact that when you look at the need to upgrade computers like we used to, for hard drive speed, for better graphics processing, for better processing on the core, for all the things that we used to have to do because the enhancements not only to the UI were pretty extensive, but you look at the fact that the programs these days don't require much more, and there hasn't been a significant innovation into, 3D or some other type of graphics need or calculation need. There's no reason really to upgrade your PC. Think about it. Think about how years ago you used to upgrade your PC on a regular basis and what's happened recently. You probably have the same computer for a while now, right? And you're probably not even thinking about upgrading unless something really is starting to sound all sorts of clickety-clackety inside of there, right? So this all is coming to a fore, and then you have to then add back the tablet issue, the cloud issue. And Microsoft really is having a very difficult time. Now, Google did come out with some reasonable numbers, but their clicks in terms of pricing per click was down. And obviously, the stock had been priced to perfection prior to this. Now, what I found most interesting was that after these numbers came out, and when you look around at the futures overnight, they were down pretty significantly. The NASDAQ 100 futures were down, 35 points, and S&P futures were down, 5 or 6 points, and it kind of carried that into the morning. Well, by the afternoon, miraculously, they all kind of came up very, very strongly and to a point of just about break even. Now, maybe the bank earnings for the week, where we saw Morgan Stanley and Capital One and a few others that came in better, well, that was exciting. But if you look at the markets, there was only about 30, 32% of stocks that were up, and that helped push up markets to about a break-even point, which is pretty remarkable if you think about it. The participation is pretty low. But at the same time, we are still seeing a very questionable period of levels that we call overheated. The KRI index, which I talk about quite often, which is the key reversal index, is once again at a level that has to be saying, hey, wait a minute, markets are getting a little bit hot right here. We hit a 4 and a 3 several times last week. The 5 is the magic number that is like, wait a minute, stop, recalculate immediately. But we see this and we're starting to get clusters of the indexing a level of about 4 or 3 and 4 and back to 4 and 3. That is a warning sign. That means that things are getting a little bit too hot. And while there is seemingly no risk in the markets where the VIX hit 12.5 or so on Friday, even with all the things that are going on, and oil seems to have nowhere to go but up, which is quite amazing. And I've talked about here, and I've been wrong about oil for some time now. There is obviously something else going on, and you have to listen to it. Can't fight it. But when we look at the economics and we saw the Philly Fed was much better than anticipated, all right, that's one for the plus column. And the other economics that we saw, you have to say to yourself, you know what? Really, if you look at the timing of when the market turned and you look at the timing of when the market went down and back up, it's all central bank initiated. Obviously, Bernanke had to do a walk back on what he talked about, where he's going to do some tapering, and then markets just got all sorts of pissed off, and bonds got sold up pretty hard, and then they reversed on a dime once he said, well, that's not exactly what I was saying, it's not going to happen right now, and tapering will happen, but, and, you know, if you look at things, it's not really what it looks like, and this is the game they play, and unfortunately, this is a newer form of a Fed that just doesn't shut up. They just don't stop talking. Well, let's talk about some of the other things that are going on in the markets. When we look at earnings, because it just started the earnings season, we are seeing that essentially there's about 60 or 70% of the companies, not many, that have beaten EPS estimates, but sales are lagging just like we thought they would be. And the question is, you know, how long are they going to be able to hold on to the continuation of seeing earnings growth of any sort when revenues are slipping? Case in point would be IBM. Now, IBM came out with their earnings, and while their numbers were better, revenues were pretty lousy. Now, remember, IBM buys back stock on a regular basis, and this helps their overall EPS. That's a question I'm going to ask Jim John O'Shaughnessy when I talk to him, because I want to understand a little bit more about his impression of earnings-adjusted P.E. ratios and EPS numbers. This week we have coming up some economics. We do have two guests, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about some of the things up front here. We have some economics that are somewhat important, not a really big week, but yet there are some things. We have the existing home sales coming out right off the bat, and that looks like it's going to be expecting to see about a 5.2 million annual rate, which would be the highest we've seen in some time on existing home sales. Although the growth on a month-over-month basis is down a bit to 1.4%. We also saw the NAHB numbers come out last week, and those were pretty good. Those are, matter of fact, very high and very impressive. We have the Richmond Manufacturing Index coming out on the 24th, as well as the new home sales numbers, looking for 485,000 on that. Slight dip on a growth on a month-over-month basis as well. And durable goods will be on the 25th. And it seems these days that durable goods, if they're bad, it doesn't matter. And if it's good, it doesn't matter. And University of Michigan is going to round it off for the week. The final July number, expecting 84 from a preliminary of about 83.9. Again, above 80 is a pretty good number when it comes to that. So that therefore, we're seeing some good things in the consumer market. Consumers continue to spend. And that's what the economy is all about. Although we are seeing also at the same time some specific areas in the consumer space not do as well. We have some earnings coming out next week. Let me give you the highlights of the earnings, by the way. These are just the highlights and the things that I want you to look at. Only a few companies, but they're really the ones that you have to pay attention to. On the 22nd, we have McDonald's coming out, and they're expected to be right before 8 o'clock in the morning, and we'll see if their same-store sales and their projections are doing well, considering the global headwinds that they have. Travelers Insurance Company on the 23rd, DuPont on the 23rd as well. DuPont had that
Nelson Peltz had taken a big position in it and moved DuPont dramatically, expecting about, we're looking for about $1.27 on DuPont. Then we have United Technologies and AT&T. And also on the 24th, this is going to be great to watch. We have Boeing coming out in the morning and looking for about $1.50 per share of earnings. And then Caterpillar looking for $1.63. Caterpillar will be very interesting to watch because of the whole Japanese situation and how the prices in Japan have gone down due to the fact that the yen has depreciated so significantly. So that's kind of the big picture. We also have, I guess, 3M coming out at the end of the week as well. Now, one of the things I want you to watch here is the fact that we are seeing that investor sentiment, or at least somewhere there's money coming into the markets, rather, you know, regardless of what's going on. 1,700 on the S&P 500 is a target that is in within range. And, you know, whenever you have those round numbers, those handles that are like, wow, we never got that before, they become very strong magnets towards moving. But at the same time, you know, right around there, at the same time, there's a lot of resistance. But right now, when you look at the big picture, the global situation is slowing. We've talked about this. And at the same time, right here, economics and earnings are just okay, you know, on the whole, on the total package. But we do have Bernanke behind us. So that's, I guess, something very good. That's, you know, going to be driving things for a while until all of a sudden they're not. So that's something that you really need to focus in on. The other thing that I want to kind of talk about is, you know, the movement recently of emerging markets, because emerging markets have been just absolutely abysmal. We've seen continued slide in Brazil. Mexico has been pretty awful. China's been a rough spot. Asia's been okay. Europe is the one that's going to be coming under scrutiny right now with the downgrades we saw of Italy, the downgrades we saw of France, and the banking sector having all, you know, so many problems. But again, with the central bank and Draghi behind everything that's going on there and pulling the strings, I do wonder how much that's really going to, you know, show an effect. Finally, before we get to the guests, I want to mention that we put up what I thought was an interesting video on Tesla on, I think it was last Wednesday. Tesla was one of those stocks that had the opportunity to take a quick scalp trade on the short side, but you had to get out immediately. And if you look at the chart and the pattern that we laid out for you over there, I think that you'll find some things that are really interesting. So you can go over to Trigger Point Research and check out the video section, or over to YouTube, which is youtube.com/Trigger Research or Trigger Point Research. I'll just look up Tesla Trigger Point Research or my name. You'll find it. So let's get to the guests, and then we'll kind of go through a few more things. All right, with us now is Jim O'Shaughnessy from O'Shaughnessy Asset Management. He's also a guy that I have followed for many years, and he has some books out that really were very, I think, were extremely influential in my career, particularly when you talk about quantitative type of analysis. So, Jim, how are you?
I'm very well.
Great.
Thank you.
Listen, you're going to get a lot more time to talk on here than you did some of those other talk shows. We won't mention the name.
Which shall remain nameless.
Yeah, exactly. So you put out a few articles I think were really great because they talked about so many things that I think are kind of in the market right now, but a lot of people are not thinking about. Because when we're in the U.S., and a lot of people and a lot of listeners from the U.S., we kind of think about that being the world, right?
Right.
And there's so many things going outside the world besides the stock market, and aside from, for example, you know, just you know, what's happening with earnings. You know, so you wrote something on that. You wrote something on the passive and income investing and active investing and income, which I thought was really fascinating, because you said that in the area of having the ability to create income, generate income, it's the worst market in 140 years, huh?
Yeah, it's amazing. When we went back and looked at the data, we ourselves were shocked. I mean, we knew that things, particularly on the fixed income side, were very, very bleak. But when we looked at a whole variety of income-producing assets, we were near the bottom of the barrel in every one of them, with the exception of the international stock dividends.
Hmm.
Wow. So what we found was, you know, for example, we have a portfolio called Enhanced Dividend, which currently has a 5.4% dividend yield. You know, compare that to the 10-year Treasury. Compare that to a CD rate, and you know, clearly it blows the doors off of those other instruments. And so one of the things that we explored was actually what would happen if an investor simply put their money into the enhanced dividend strategy and then consumed all the dividends, used it as an income producer. What we found was really interesting. It really only the dividend level that they achieved over all rolling 10-year periods was almost always about 100% higher than it was in the previous 10 years. And dividends actually only went down, your dividend yield, they actually only went down a handful of times. I think, I don't have it right in front of me, but I think it was 5 to 7 times. And then, for example, take the year 2008, worst year for the stock market since the early 30s in terms of calendar year performance. Worst year since 1931. And yet, what we found was, even though the portfolio itself lost nearly half of its corpus value, the income that it provided to you as something for you to be able to spend actually went up.
Right.
And it went up because, you know, when the stock price goes down, the dividend yield goes up. So essentially that year we saw a doubling of dividends from, you know, very, very financially strong and stable companies. So if you were going to just use it for income, you could still do that. And then at the end of the study, you find that, you know, you've made a whole ton of money on the capital appreciation side of it.
Right.
But it's difficult for investors to wrap their heads around using stocks in that kind of manner, you know, because of all the behavioral reasons that we know all about, people really freak out and tend to not be able to stick with their investment when times get really, really rough. However, if they could change their focus away from the value, overall value of the portfolio, and make the focus, well, how much money am I drawing out of this to spend every year? Then things could have gone much, much better for investors, because they would have seen, gosh, I've just lived through the worst year since 1931, and guess what? In 2009, I'm going to have X number of dollars more to consume.
Right, exactly. All right, so, you know, the income that people are getting, though, I mean, you talk about the stock yield, and of course we've seen that many companies have been raising their dividends for a lot of different reasons, because, one, we do know that when you raise your dividend, it obviously benefits the shareholders. Many of the shareholders are, you know, the owners, if you will, the management, et cetera. It also helps because you, if you bought back shares over time, or if you're going to buy back shares, it increases the income back to you, right? So you pay out less. So there's all these different things that are happening there. Plus, also, there may be some advantages to do so. Maybe some things that's going on inside the company. They don't want to just hold on to the cash. They don't see other opportunities. But what's really interesting was that at the end of last year, where there was increased potential for taxes on dividends, and we saw the acceleration of dividends into the end of the year, right?
Right.
And it kept going this year, too.
Yeah.
That was really interesting.
Well, also, the underlying demographics are playing out here as well. Baby boomers, you know, are beginning to retire, and they're in desperate need of income. A lot of the boards of these companies are, you know, intentionally paying out a bigger dividend, trying to make their stock more attractive to that baby boomer investor.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is, I don't know if I ever talked to you about this, but you're the perfect guy to talk to about this. I've always had this question about when you take stock out of the market through buybacks. And now you have, well, let's use a company as an example. I think it's a really good example. That would be, I suppose it would be IBM.
Okay.
IBM has been buying back their shares, I think, forever.
Yeah.
And in big, you know, quietly, but yet in a big amount. So what happens is less shares on the market. There's obviously X amount of revenue. You divide it by the shares, and then you get the earnings per share from that. So there's less shares outstanding. Essentially, if you have the same revenue always, you're going to have a higher and higher earnings per share, right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay. So why don't we have why is it not standardized to have a buyback adjusted EPS?
That's a really good question. Maybe because it would be difficult to, you know, put a new metric in there that people would be willing to pay attention to. You know, on shareholder yield, which is a factor that we use, shareholder yield takes the dividend yield and adds the buyback yield, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we run a large cap product called Market Leaders Value, and we the final factor is we buy the companies with the highest shareholder yield.
Right.
That has been a tremendous performer over the years, you know, sort of taking both into account. You end up with not a dividend yield of 5.4%, but you end up with a above-market dividend yield, and then that particular portfolio has more of a goal of capital appreciation on the value side.
Right.
But, you know, historically, we took shareholder yield and buyback yield back to 1926 using the CRSP data, that's the Chicago Research and Security Prices data. And, you know, for all rolling five-year periods, it's above the market like 95% of the time.
Mm, wow.
So it has a huge win rate going back to 1926. And it makes sense because of what you just mentioned. It makes the company look better, right?
Until right.
We do come up,
right.
Until we do come up with a buyback-adjusted earnings per share. It makes the shareholders very happy because it supports the price. And it's just an excellent tool for companies to use to get money back to shareholders that is not taxed.
Right. Right.
So for all those reasons, we love shareholder yield as well. But obviously, that's going to be for a different type of investor. That's going to be for the investor who's more concerned with capital appreciation than they are with actual dividend yield that
right.
they want to consume.
Right. But you do agree that having that metric, if it was available, would be a reasonable thing to do. I mean, obviously, companies don't really want to do that. IBM's revenues have been coming down for years.
Right.
And they keep on beating. And they keep on raising their EPS. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I think if you should make it your cause.
Ah, make it my cause. Good. You know, one of the things is that, you know, and just for everybody to understand something also, that Jim's books and all, they're I would say, would you agree they're not stories, generally speaking?
They're definitely not stories.
Right.
I only wrote one book that was really kind of a What Works on Wall Street light, and it was called How to Retire Rich.
Right.
That tells more of the tale in stories.
Right.
We do use. I used to joke when I was giving speeches that we have to tell stories to remind us why stories are not a good way to invest. you know, it's basic human nature. We respond to and get much more interested in a narrative.
Yeah.
And causality is very important to us.
Right.
And we're kind of like the early pioneers of this big data movement. We are much more interested in as much and as massive amounts of data as we can get. Because we believe that by studying how things do over very long periods of time, you're going to get a very good idea about how they might perform in the future. We look at things called base rates, or how often a strategy beats its underlying benchmark in all rolling 1, 3, 5, 7, and 10-year periods. Obviously, we're looking for strategies with super high base rates, and we have several that have, you know, 10-year base rates that are currently 100%. Now, we don't think they'll remain 100%, but they might remain in the high 90s. We've had strategies we've been able to test back to the 1920s that have 10-year base rates in the 95% rate.
Mm.
Our idea is, you know, there is the possible and there is the probable. We much rather would bet on the probable.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
is it
that makes
possible?
Sense.
Is it possible in 2008 that the U.S. financial system could have completely melted down and gone away? Yeah, it's possible. Was not probable. Everyone knew that the Fed would do everything it took to make that not happen.
Yeah.
So in terms of stock market investing, we always want to be going with something that we've tested over as long a period of time as we can that has the highest base rates with kind of the lowest volatility. So we're looking very much also at risk-adjusted rates of return, because we know, essentially, volatility terrifies investors, both professional and amateur alike. So we really are trying to deliver portfolios that offer what investors are hoping for in terms of either capital appreciation or income or a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
And we like to study vast swaths of data that get us there.
Yeah.
You know, for example, I'll give you a tease of the next commentary that I'm writing. And it's basically, I think you know that I wrote a piece in March of 2009 called Generational Buying Opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
In equities. And, you know, since that time, equities have more than doubled. If you look at them, even on an inflation-adjusted basis, they've gone up. You know, the S&P on an inflation-adjusted basis since that article was written is compounded at 19.78,
mm-hmm.
turning 100,000 into 218 or 219,000.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you'd left your money in the long run, the 20-year U.S. Treasury, you would have compounded at 3.9%, turning your 100,000 into 218,000.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when we get these very long trends, we very rarely make predictions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we tend to do so, it seems to be because we have met an inflection point. And we believe that we have met an inflection point on the long bond. We believe the commentary is going to, I'll tell you what it's going to be about. I'll give you the title. A Generational Selling Opportunity for Long Bonds.
What do you think of that? That's catchy. I mean, that nothing like recycling titles, huh?
We think that, I mean, right now, we look at all rolling 40-year returns to the long bond. And something really fascinating happened. That was, back to 1900, there had never been a 40-year period where the long bond had compounded north of 4% per year. Now, these are real, so inflation-adjusted numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, in 2008, we've got a whole host of them, more than 30 times on a rolling basis. And we think that it's kind of hit its high in April of this year. And what really is interesting, we're big believers in reversion to the mean,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Ultimately, when things have super great performance over long periods of time, they tend to regress through the average return and have pretty bad performance over the time. Well, you know, in April, the S&P on a cumulative basis, when you compared it to the long-term average, was 3.5 standard deviations above the average.
Right.
That is huge.
Right.
That almost never happens. Couple that with the fact that we've seen it happening on a 10-year basis, a 20-year basis, et cetera. It's basically the result of investing in September of 1981 when real interest rates were like 14.5% and riding that wave, right? So we think that when Bernanke stops the QE, the party is truly and fully over for long bond investors.
Well, what about stocks? You said the stocks were three times the... Did you say stocks are three times their average in April?
As a matter of fact, stocks are actually well below their long-term 40-year real rate of return.
Right, a 40-year long-term. I mean, when we look at a Z-score over a shorter period of time, they're pretty much... they just came down a bit, but they're pretty much to the top of their levels.
Right.
You know, short term.
Yeah, we definitely have to distinguish between short and long term.
But Jim, I got to ask you something. You know, I know that if I recall correctly, because actually, you should have got a thank you note because I believe it was when you wrote What Works on Wall Street. You did the research with Capital IQ, was it, or Standard Poor's?
CompuStat.
Right. Are they around anymore? I don't know if they're
right. Yeah, sure, absolutely.
So they were pretty pricey, but I bit the bullet and bought it. And that's, good stuff, you know, really cool stuff. And, you know, obviously for past data and all, I mean, these days it's a lot more from when I bought it and when you wrote that book. I mean, that was a lot of manual stuff that you had to crunch. You know, today, these days it's a lot easier with some of the tools, but still not terribly easy. But you went back, you know, a long time. I mean, you went back to, let's call it the early 1900s, I think it was, right? Maybe even a little bit before that.
Yeah, actually, that's in the most recent edition of the book goes back to the 1926 period.
Right.
In the original version of the book, we only went back annually to the 1950s and monthly to the 1960s.
Okay, so I have a question for you because I've always been very puzzled about something.
Sure.
There's another gentleman who wrote a book called Stocks for the Long Run, Jeremy Siegel.
Jeremy Siegel, yeah. I know it well.
I'm not going to do my imitation of him right now, okay? Because it's good, but I'm not doing it. But Jeremy Siegel, you know, and of course CNBC, or not, I didn't say that. Some of the places, when stocks are starting to move pretty low and all that, guess who comes on? You know, they bring them on to be the parade of goodwill. But
yes.
what's interesting is that, if I recall correctly, his data supposedly goes back, I mean, to like some ridiculous amount of time, like to the 1800s or something, or early 1800s, some weird time.
And I was, yes, that's true.
How is that possible?
Well, it's possible if you're willing to accept five stocks as an index.
Ah, I see. So those five stocks could have been like, you know, whatever those stocks were that were the only game in town.
Yeah.
And could have had some extraordinary returns or bad, whatever. Interesting. Yeah, 'cause I never really understood that.
Yeah, and so we recreated the Powell's index when we looked trying to find 20-year real rates of return going back to the 19th century. I got to tell you, I think really for high quality data, you're pretty much gonna have to start at 1900.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Because, I mean, obviously, you know, you want to get not only that, you want consistency and you want to have, you know, the other thing is that when you're doing your data screens and all that, I mean, we look at things like, you know, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, for example. Well, that's obviously only 30 stocks, but those stocks do change over time. So, you know,
that's a lot.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, there's a lot of studies. They had IBM in the Dow briefly, like in the 30s. And then they kicked it out for another stock. Well, IBM went on to go up like 50 times, and the stock that they put in its place just doubled. So had they simply left IBM in the Dow, the Dow would be a lot higher today. And also, the other thing people don't understand about the Dow is the modern-day Dow of 30 industrials, aren't even industrials anymore now because you've got tech companies in there. But it wasn't created until 1928. Prior to that, there were like 14 names in that index, and they weren't all industrials. They had some railroads in there. And so even the history of some of our best-known indexes is not very well understood.
Right. And the other thing is I know that you have, for example, in one of your books, you talk about all the different possible strategies that are out there. As a matter of fact, in my first book, The Disciplined Investor, I discussed one of your strategies as an example of what a quantitative approach is. It was simple, the dogs of the Dow. And, you know, what's interesting is that if you think about it for a second, I don't know if today is the same, but let's take 2 years ago. There were things in the Dow that were not dividend. There was two or three stocks that were not dividend producing stocks. So you do the dogs of the Dow in that point. Now you're only doing maybe 27 or 26 stocks out of the 30, which skews the whole concept.
Yeah, no question. We, as a matter of fact, tested out using shareholder yield as opposed to dividend yield.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found was it works it actually works a little better.
Right.
And so that was one way of getting around that. You know, of course, we haven't done a dogs of the Dow strategy in, you know, decades.
Right.
I think you used the strategy in the appropriate manner because it's a great, simple strategy that demonstrates what quantitative investing is all
right.
about.
Exactly. Well, Jim O'Shaughnessy, we've got to leave it right there. There's a couple of great pieces that he wrote. Also, his books are available. And, of course, O'Shaughnessy Asset Management is the place you want to go for, you know, quantitative investment funds and all sorts of good things. We'll put all the information on the show notes and keep writing these great pieces. And no listener is going to spill the beans about I do have one question. Do you think you came up with a generational buying opportunity, generational low? Because Doug Kass was spouting that out for a while, remember?
Well, yeah, I do remember. All I can tell you is I'm looking at the piece right now, and it was published March 16th, 2009.
Nice. That's nice. It's a good day.
I'll let Doug use it, too. It's a good term.
Yeah, I think you need to trademark that. I think that could be a whole thing. You know what I mean? Generational buying fund. You look for those. By the way, the other thing, I'll just end on this, is when this bond situation, obviously, we know it's inevitable. Let's just be honest, okay?
Yes.
The question is when. The thing is that then is a big question out there, because while I agree that there's some good dividend yield on stocks and all that, you got to think about the bigger picture here and talk about people And you got to talk about people with different risk tolerance, and that's not appropriate for. It's just not appropriate for.
Yep.
Where the heck are they going to put their money? It's a really, or better yet, I'll say it a different way. Those people who have been hanging on to bonds all those years that maybe have, let's say, a 5% muni or a 5% whatever it is, and they got some good money out of it and it starts reversing, you know, they're going to dump those. And then what?
That's the trillion-dollar question.
Yeah, I don't know. I've been scratching my head about it because we've been shortening up duration for clients for some time.
Actually, that's this piece that I'm working on right now is that's our solution.
Yeah.
You know, get out of any bond that has duration more than 5 years.
And I think the other thing is, you probably did this because you know these things, but one of the things that really troubles me is the skew ratios.
Which
just to the listeners is that how much can a bond move with a very, let's call it short-term interest rate move? So what happens is that, for example, you have a 0.5% yield on Treasury, let's just say, you know, or whatever, your 2 year, whatever it is. But going from 0.5% to 1% is doubling.
Yeah, that's right.
Of the yield, and you kind of take that along the yield curve. And the problem is that how do bonds react to that across the board? We saw last month, one of the worst months we saw in June, one of the worst months for bonds in a very long time.
Yeah, and I expect more of the same over the next 20 years.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm with you. All right, Jim O'Shaughnessy, I appreciate you spending some time with us today.
Great to be with you.
All right, thanks, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And our next guest is Stan Dash, and he's over at TradeStation, and he's the Vice President of Applied Technical Analysis. Why I wanted to bring him on was, you know, I mentioned everybody that we're doing a lot of work with TradeStation. And of course, you know, I'm really big into, you know, not only the fundamental stuff, but also the technical. And I thought that we'd bring him on, talk about some of the new things that are happening over at TradeStation, which I really like, and also some of the things that are happening in the industry. So, Stan, how are you, buddy?
Very well. Thanks, Andrew.
You know, we could have actually gotten together and do this. You're right. You know, you're not too far from me. Just down the block. So, a couple of things. In terms of TradeStation, I know that one of the big things is obviously that you have probably the best charting package that I've seen, and not only that, the way that it's presented is great. You know, there's a lot of new things that have happened recently in terms of the things that are coming out, the things that you have. You want to kind of just bring me up to date with some of that?
Yeah, a whole bunch of stuff has come out lately, Andrew, and not every trader will use every feature, and it's like that in any piece of software that we use for trading or anything else. What we want to do as individuals is find those things that will contribute to our doing better analysis and better trading. So one of the things we came out with not long ago was timestamping down to the second, so you can make sub-minute bars. You can make a 15-second bar, a 30-second bar. Not everyone will want to do that.
Yeah,
not everyone is going to trade on,
right.
Of course, a micro level like that. And just because it's there doesn't mean you should even try.
Right.
But if you are interested in doing some of that real micro breaking down the timestamps even further, you can do that now in TradeStation.
Right.
Some of the other things that you're aware of course, has been the expansion of what we call Easy Language.
Mm-hmm.
Easy Language, it gets accused of being misnamed, but we'll call it Easy Language, is the language we use, and it's an open platform language for writing indicators and trading strategies. Well, it's been expanded in the last couple of years tremendously to include objects. Now, if you're not involved in developing formulas and working with those, what does it mean to you? Well, what it really means is that it gives a chance for people like you, Andrew, or other developers to write more sophisticated tools. Sophisticated isn't always better, but more efficient tools, to be a little more creative with being able to write formulas for market analysis and strategies. And, of course, if you do want to learn it, we have tools for teaching it, and you can roll up your sleeves and dig right in.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is a lot of people – I get emails a lot, and people say, you know, how do I figure out if, for example – I mean, I'll take something simple. You know, like, you know, I want a list of the stocks that do – you know, that have these characteristics as an example, and then I'd like to take a look at them, you know, but I'm having a hard time finding it. Now, there's a couple of free things. We'll call that the screener because you have that too.
Sure.
And so there's a screener. You can pretty much screen on any particular field. Let's call it price, for example.
Right.
But you could also screen on something like stocks that are crossing the 50-day in a particular series. So the S&P 500 stocks that are above their 50-day average. And then you can create from there a list that you'd use, that you'd just plop in a radar screen, which you have, and just kind of have that list all the way, you know, always there available for you. Or maybe there's something you have that is
one of the things that our guys in the data area have done that's really fantastic is to create these different lists. And using these lists combined with the features in TradeStation that can do various types of scans and monitoring, sorting, ranking, that's really a great combination, because we have lists of the S&P 500, the NASDAQ 100, or the hundreds of other lists. So you at least have a starting point. I once put together a list from the S&P 500 and three or four other big cap indexes. I put them all in one window. Then I just sorted them alphabetically and took out the duplicates. I did it by hand. It only took me 3 minutes. But then I had a list of probably the 600 or 700 most liquid stocks in the United States.
Right, exactly. It's easy to do. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, there's so many platforms. I've worked on a lot of platforms, okay, you know, and tested them out and all that. And I'm not, this is not a commercial for TradeStation, but the point is that I think that you, when it comes to trading or even investing, the worst thing that would happen is if you're constantly just carrying around this giant anvil with you because you don't know how to use the system.
Right.
You know, then what? You know, how do you deal with that?
Well, yeah, you end up a little bit intimidated by
it. But, right.
You know, it's very interesting. People often think that if they only knew that one more feature, that one more tool, they could conquer the world. In programming classes, we used to say, if I only knew how to create an array, I'd be a genius. And I remind people at my age, I can remind people that, you know, I was already on Wall Street for 7 or 8 years before we had a personal computer.
Right. Oh, really?
And markets existed. We managed to trade them. We would pick up the phone and place orders. We had a lot of paper charts on our desk. Now, certainly, as information flow has changed and as our access to information and computing power has changed, the dynamic has changed, but markets have not. So you need to learn to do what will serve you in your trading.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that. You know, markets have not. And just to kind of go sidestep for 1 second, I think over the last couple of 5 years, 3 years, markets have changed a lot. Some of the traditional metrics, not all of them, but some of the traditional ways of looking at things, you know, like, for example, there are several different tools you can look at for, quote-unquote, overbought or oversold, right?
Sure, of course.
But it appears to me that the only side that you can use of that these days is the oversold. Because overbought doesn't seem to ever really matter so much as it did years ago.
Well, I know your experience is broad, but you know, you have to look beyond just the bull market, and we've had a heck of a market.
Right, I'm just talking about recently. That's all I'm talking about. Yeah,
yeah. So you're gonna in a bull market. You know, one thing you learn in technical analysis, and unfortunately, neophytes sometimes get stuck on this. They see overbought or oversold, and they say, "Well, the market has to go the other way."
Right.
And what we know is that a market can stay overbought or oversold for a long time. The key is to look for, not that it's overbought or oversold, but when it's coming out of that condition, sometimes that's the better trigger.
Right, when it reverses, yeah.
Sure, an oscillator can lock, especially a stochastic, that can really get locked at high levels. RSI a little less so, but stochastic in particular, they can get locked and overbought and oversold and stay up there for quite a long time.
Right, exactly.
So, and my point about markets not changing, maybe I was a little bit too glib, but you know, it's still motivated by you and me trying to make money.
Right, exactly.
It's still our fear and greed. It's still the people behind it. No matter how much we algo, the algos don't care.
Yeah, right. Well, they don't have to. They don't eat, drink, sleep either.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, and we've certainly seen changes in the markets with 24-hour trading.
Right, and they're trying to go 24-hour trading with stocks now, which I don't get how that's going to work.
I would say the same thing, except the changes I've seen over the years have been dramatic. So I don't think there's any reason really that it can't work. I think the resistance is probably going to come from the financial side, the bookkeeping side, and having to settle things out. But futures markets have managed to do it.
But I think I think that there's some benefit to that. I think futures market is good that they're open overnight, not for the individual because most people can't deal with it. But if you're a very significant fund, let's say, or a hedge fund, I mean, the fact of the matter is that you can do work in your portfolio if you need to protect yourself or to enhance, you know, sometime in the middle of the night if your systems are, you know, aligned to do what they're doing. But
Right. There's an interesting observation, which is that the markets that have moved the fastest along that way have been the ones that are not SEC regulated.
Huh. Interesting.
And it's stocks and options that have not moved that far, and those are the ones that are SEC regulated. Now, I'm not accusing the SEC. I'm really not.
Yeah.
It's just an interesting observation, because when you get into, if you've been involved in the business a while, you can see how different structures develop in reaction and hand in hand with regulatory structures. And we need the right regulatory structures. I'm not campaigning one way or the other. But I'm just saying it's interesting how the, Forex is somewhat regulated by CFTC, and of course it's on the banking side, and futures of CFTC, but the SEC side has been much more conservative.
And my good friend, that wonderful regulator, Gary Gensler, love that guy. Love that guy. What a complete waste of just space. Just a complete waste of space. You don't have to comment on that. That's my commentary.
No comment.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about some of the new things you're doing, because I think this is really interesting. And as a matter of fact, coming up very soon, I'm going to be involved in some of this. You started not too long ago, the whole idea of additional education on a regular basis and insight into markets on through a quote-unquote blog.
Yep.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. We call the group TradeStation Labs, and I've been involved with TradeStation for a long time, and my entree into the company was to do training work. Most of that education work was towards how to use the platform. The company before we were a brokerage was selling software.
Right.
And really, there was less of a culture of using software on personal computers, even just 12 and 15 years ago. And we were training people how to use the platform. And of course, you needed a background in markets and analysis in order to communicate what was being done. But it was really a lot of click here, click there training.
Right.
And a few years ago, I really pushed to be allowed to start this TradeStation Labs initiative, which moved training from click here, click there to about markets and about trading, about market interrelationships, about technical analysis. Now, as you know, Andrew, we're not a recommending company. It's not a research department.
Right.
But what we do try and do is get people thinking and give them different perspectives, both on analytical methods in white papers, in longer shelf life presentations, and also about current market conditions, to give them things to think about. Here's what, here are levels we would identify.
Right.
If this happens, could be bullish, could be bearish. Here are the levels to keep an eye on, and here's an interesting technical condition. And obviously people have to make appropriate judgments on their own. We're not giving buy and sell signals. But that's the TradeStation Labs initiative through a blog you just mentioned, through daily webinars, and also the longer-term shelf life items are our white papers called Analysis Concepts.
Who does the white papers?
The white papers are written by me, my associate Frederick Pomleden, who just presented one today in the webinar.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Burke, who Mike, is going to be presenting one in a couple of months. He's writing the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some that were done by some analysts who we had at the company and who moved on, but we still have those logged in there. So actually we have 49 white papers already archived, and they really do have shelf life.
Right.
They also have downloadables with them. Almost all of them have a downloadable, so you could plug something into TradeStation, and it would be something you could run and test yourself.
Right.
Not a finished strategy, not the golden key. But just, this is an interesting different way to look at this indicator, a different way to look at these market comparisons.
Right. I was just thinking about something. You have this whole application strategy network where you can, there are developers out there, and TradeStation, I think, has some freebies on there, of course. So, for example, if somebody's looking for...
Yeah, some of our stuff from Labs is in there as a freebie, but,
right.
And that's all open, and... That's educational. Consider it that way.
Right. And then you have also other people that it may have specific, like, for example, you have Larry Williams has a variety of his things on there, and John Person has things on there. I mean, there's a lot of and we have things on there for different trading methods and methodologies and all that. And I know you do showcases and all that. I was thinking that, what would be interesting? This is just off the cuff, and I apologize. But, it would be kind of cool to have a more regular, just somebody looking at indicators, like in a quote unquote podcast format or some kind of like things like that, TradeStation Strategy Network. Because, for example, on the iTunes store, there's, people that not necessarily review, but they, talk about the different ones and, hey, here's what they're talking about. This is what it looks like, so that people get a little bit more of interest in it. Not the full showcase, not a full, discussion about it, but just something.
We try to do that with the showcase, and I agree with you. We need, I was also pushing for us in the education area to do something with a little more grounding on some of the indicators.
Yeah.
So that people would have some formal definitions, because many people, you and I were chatting about MACD, many people will use an indicator, and they'll use it capably, but, you know, it would be nice to have a little more of a context for it sometimes, and not necessarily to recite the formula by rote, but,
right.
but to understand the context for it.
I remember when I, way, way, way back, okay, I remember the first time I looked at a MACD, and I'm looking at it and going, okay, and I'm like, why is it set like that? I mean, I'm thinking,
right.
and by the way, not only why is it set like that, what the heck are the settings? What does that mean? I mean, not only
sure.
what do those numbers mean, and why would I do 9 day versus 3 and 10, and what you know, and you could read the stuff till you're blue in the face, and when you're new at it, though, it makes no sense at all.
Yeah.
You know, you got to kind of bring it in. It's very difficult.
You know, you mentioned the strategy network, and I think people really should take a look at it if they haven't. It is for TradeStation users, because anything you use from there gets plugged into your platform. So anybody who's not using TradeStation is welcome to look through it, but you can't use the tools because they're plugins, essentially.
Right.
But I think it's very interesting. Sometimes people are reluctant to do that, and if you think about the time and effort that you put into creating something, if there's something in there that seems to fit your style of trading,
right.
and or it's by a developer of interest, you mentioned Larry Williams, you mentioned John Person, your stuff, Andrew, you know, you might say, you know what, so let me lease it for a few months.
Right.
And it's not a big expense. I'm taking advantage of someone's market experience and, frankly, their programming ability.
Uh-huh.
And I can learn from it, and it may be a great tool that I keep. And if it's not for me, that's okay. I can move on.
Right.
But it's really not a very expensive way to sample real-time technical analysis.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. I totally agree. Now, in terms of – I know there's a lot of things happening at TradeStation. You were purchased by Monex, which I think is, if I'm not mistaken, is it the largest brokerage firm in Japan?
I believe it's actually the third largest online firm.
Wow.
And if I said something wrong, I hope the boss doesn't.
Yeah, no, we'll keep it quiet.
I think that's where it fits.
Keep it very, very quiet.
Yeah.
The other things are, in terms of some of the things that I have recently found, you know, very interesting, you know, one of the, I always talk to people about this on the podcast and all. I'm like, listen, stock ABC, what you want to do is take a look at it, blah, 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 and blah, you know, and if it hits $52, maybe you want to look at it that way and this way and this way. Or I explain some trading technology, and I have things called, you know, stops. Of course, you do stops. But stops are a problem sometimes. For example, you know, you have a stock that gaps down, gaps up, depending on which side of it you're on.
Yep.
And you have a stop in there. And you get whacked. And then you're looking at the next day, and you're looking at your statement, you're like, I don't think it ever hit that spot. You know, mm-hmm. what happened? You know, so it maybe happened pre-market, whatever. And then I have something that we call soft stops. And a soft stop really is a fancy name for an alert.
Okay.
You know, so that you have the ability to understand. Now, there's a few websites out there that you can put in stocks, and you can put in an alert. And I don't know if you pay for it or not, but one of the things that we use a lot is we use alerts. And through TradeStation, which I think is really convenient because not all platforms have this in this method, whereas you can actually put, and we like doing this sometimes, an email address we use text, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
You can use texting to text yourself, you know, even though you may be in the office, that this is happening. Or
right.
if you really want to get annoyed, you can use the Ahuga.
Yeah, actually, I like setting the text-to-speech engine. So, and I write a lot of my own alerts criteria, so... Occasionally, I'll have an alert that'll say something like, why are you still long this position?
Oh, nice.
But it abuses me into making
right.
sure I cut my loss.
You should hear what my Siri name is on the iPhone. It's nasty. But, yeah. No, so, and the other thing is that, you know, oftentimes in charting, there are... we'll say that, you know, nobody uses a line, I don't think, per se, for a chart. You know, you use a candlestick, you're using a high, low, open, close, you're using, mm-hmm. You know, something of that nature. And one of the other things you have is a variety of the, we'll call it the Japanese style
right.
indicators and cloud formations and all that. And those are pretty cool. I mean, do you use any of those?
Yeah, I do look at some of them. Well, actually, it's interesting. If you break them down into three categories, we have some good educational videos on the site about this. The way to organize all those in your head to get your head around them is summertime based. You're traditionally the daily or 60 minute or some time based. Some are activity based, like tick bars and volume bars. And the ones you're driving at are price based.
Yeah.
Meaning the chart builds based on price either range or reversal of price. Some price action characteristic determines the bars. They're not always bars. They're graphically a little different. But it's the same idea that when the market moves a certain amount, I move over one column to the right or one bar to the right. I've experimented with some of those, but actually one of those is a very traditional one that I've used for many years, which is point and figure, which is not Japanese per se. It comes from, I think Charles Dow actually had a name for it and began to work with it, 100 and some odd years ago. So point and figure is like that in that it is price-based. And that's what all these others are. So once you get your head around that, it's a little easier to learn them because then you say, okay, what are the price characteristics that go into the construction of the bars or whatever the graphic could be, a line or a brick, different constructions. I think they're very useful alternatives to seeing the market. They have certain drawbacks, not as does any charting method, but the drawback is there is no time element. So if we're time-oriented, for instance, if you're a day trader and you're focused on the fact that stocks are open, the major session, 6.5 hours, 390 minutes, well, you can't divide the day up into a nice symmetric format using a price-based interval.
Mm-hmm.
You need a time-based.
Right.
That's not a good or bad. That's just a difference because I know a lot of traders who do like to take 390 minutes. This is what I do. I use a lot of 130-minute bars and 65-minute bars, which divide the day evenly for the regular session. Well, I can't do that kind of division of my sampling with a Kagi or a Renko.
Right.
But I can see important price levels sometimes because of the way it's price structured. It's worth having a look at, even if it doesn't become something you adopt as your primary charting tool.
Right. I mean, it has a similarity, not exact, but a similarity to something that and the indicators we have, which are market profile based or volume. Mm-hmm. So we're really not as concerned about necessarily, the anything more than, okay, I want to know where the buying is going on, where the selling is going on, where there's consolidation points, where the block is, and when there's nothing,
Right.
And if
right.
I can identify those, I can know at least that I have a better shot, not definitely, but a better shot at having an opportunity for a really nice move versus just kind of vacillating between, $30 and $30.50 for the next, 2 weeks.
Right. So you're looking at a price distribution kind of concept.
Right. Exactly.
Or value zones or
right.
Yep.
Exactly. Sure. I mean, that we like those only because it tells, at least, what we see is it tells us a lot more about the real action in the market and at a particular price, by the way, because when you look at just to get back to like the stochastics or MACDs or the RSIs, that tells you nothing other than either a trend and kind of where the movement is. It doesn't tell you at exactly what point where that trend maybe accelerated or didn't in price zone. So that's kind of the things that we like.
Yeah, you don't really get a price level out of those oscillators.
Right. Exactly.
You may get some sense of sort of its relative location.
Right.
But you don't really get a sense of a price level to be focused on.
Exactly. Well, we're also going to have some other things. A lot of our listeners like our KRI indicator, which is our key reversal indicator, which we rank from a -5 to a +5. +5 is overheating in a real big way. Mm-hmm. -5 is a and this is different than some of the other ones where you get a overbought, oversold, and very simple. This takes in a variety of things into account. And when you get to a +5, for example, and you start clustering in that area, and we have I don't know if I showed you this, we have an indicator we built for this, you start getting really concerned about that because it's not just a simple overbought. It starts clustering in that really stretched zone.
And you're getting a little more weight of evidence.
Yeah, exactly. And then we kind of do a lot of coloring of it. It changes the color, gradients up. And then we also have our gauge, our famous gauge, which people like to see. And we're going to put that in an indicator as well coming up. But anyway, listen, so what I do encourage everybody to do is to a couple of things. Number one, if you are a TradeStation user, obviously go over and check out the various blogs, training materials, and all that. There's a lot on that site that you can find. And also check out the Strategy Network. And the second thing is that if you're not a TradeStation user, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, okay? I just saw this. You guys are giving away the platform for free until the end of the year or something like that?
Yeah, there's an offer running. I don't want to quote the details of it to hear, because it'll be, you know, a recording, and it'll depend on the kind of account you open and things like that. But there are some advantageous offerings right now.
Right.
If people want to take a look at opening an account, we just announced a repricing on some of our flat ticket pricing for those who trade larger size per order. So there's more advantageous pricing for those traders, more advantageous pricing for traders who trade the larger number of options contracts per order. So we have what we try to do is tailor them so that based on a person's style of trading, we can offer the most advantageous offering, and obviously make the appropriate revenue for the company. So it's a win-win.
Absolutely. Stan Dash, I appreciate you coming on, and I will speak to you real soon, and probably one of these days we'll have a quick lunch when I'm over there.
I appreciate it, Andrew, and I look forward to seeing your stuff in our blog.
That'd be great. Yeah, we'll start, I think, next week or the week after. We're gonna throw up our first ones.
Excellent. I appreciate it.
All right, talk to you, Stan. Bye.
Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks. Looking to wrap it up for this week, this show, this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, coming on the end of July, and now that options expiration is over, which often is a time that we see markets do a quick reversal, and adding to the fact that the KRI indicator is at a 4, I wonder what we're going to see there. Plenty of stocks to be moving around with right now, plenty of things to be looking at, having on your watch list, and we will bring some of those to you in video. Also, the setups over on TPR, Trigger Point Research, that you could check out. And more importantly, we just added another feature for current users and subscribers that we are doing some very special setups and get ready types of alerts that we are sending to them on a regular basis. So if you haven't signed up for that, check out triggerpointresearch.com/free trial. I'll see you soon. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.